Four plaintiffs have sued every Catholic diocese in the state of Illinois. They say they were abused by members of the clergy and that church leaders covered it up. Here's their lawyer, Jeff Anderson.
A conspiracy of silence, a conspiracy of secrecy, a conspiracy of self-protection.
Also, Americans owe a total of nearly $1.5 trillion in student loans. We'll break down where Illinois' candidates stand on how to fix the problem of student debt. And as we think about Sears filing for bankruptcy and what that means for the retail world, Cornell University historian Lewis Hyman wants people to remember how the catalog was available to African Americans during the Jim Crow era. Here he is on the Media.
It's not the sort of unambiguous story of positivity, but it is a story of access. And I think that's something to consider as we think about what digital capitalism means in the 21st century.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, we'll be focusing on a new lawsuit brought against every Catholic diocese in the state of Illinois and another aspect of Sears' history that has emerged since the retailer's bankruptcy filing. Back when it was first around as a catalog company, we'll hear how African Americans in the South were able to buy from those catalogs and subvert Jim Crow era laws. But first, Election Day is officially 2 weeks from today. And as we inch closer and closer to the election, we've been recording interviews with candidates running for several statewide offices. We'll be playing those for you all of next week. Before then, we've also been asking you what questions you had for the candidates. And today, we're tackling a question from Jeff Martin in Springfield.
So I would like to know what their plans are or what they would do to reduce the exorbitant cost of obtaining your education.
Thanks for that question, Jeff. The average student owes more than $30,000 in debt, and this is an issue that directly affects more than 40 million people nationwide. Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines has set out to answer this question for Jeff, and she's in studio now to tell us what she found when it comes to people running for governor, attorney general, and for the House of Representatives. Hi, Lee. Welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us on the line from L.A. is Natalia Abrams. Natalia is the executive director of StudentDebtCrisis.org. That's a nonprofit that advocates for state and federal policies to lessen the impact of student debt. Hi, Natalia. Thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you, Nyla. Happy to be here.
And Natalia, I just mentioned a couple statistics in the beginning, and we know, I think everyone has a vague sense at least. If it's not something you're dealing with personally, student debt is a huge problem in this country. But how big is it? Can you quantify for us?
Yeah, it's quite large. It's $1.5 trillion of overall student loan debt, and there are 45 million borrowers. This is nationwide. Illinois itself has almost $50 billion in total student loan debt and almost 2 million borrowers that hold that debt. So this is very much a national problem as much as it is an Illinois problem.
And when we think about this being a problem, Natalia, you mentioned those numbers. It's also obviously not just the people who are holding that debt that's affected, right? I wonder how we can think about how this spreads out and ripples out to the broader society and economy.
Yeah, of course. I think the best way to think about it is dominoes, that if you have a ton of student debt, if you have 30,000, you're lucky. But we talk with people that have 50 to 100,000. That means their payments monthly are over $1,000 per month. And when they can't make their bills, they can't purchase cars, they can't purchase homes, they can't contribute to our overall economy. And that's how it affects all of us. In the same way we saw with the housing crisis, you know, not all of us were homeowners, but that crisis affected all of us nationwide.
And so, Lee, what Natalia is saying is not unlike actually what you heard from Jeff Martin, because you followed up with him. He's the one who posed that question. And what did he say about his personal experience and why he wanted to ask this question?
Yeah, I had the sense just hearing that question that he definitely had a story to tell. So he deals with it on a personal and a professional level. He's actually a high school admissions advisor for the Midwest Technical Institute. So he's talking to
prospective students.
Yeah, prospective students all the time. And he said the number one issue they're dealing with is the affordability of a higher education. And he really gets that because he took out about $30,000 in student loans when he was between the ages of 19 and 21. He's 40 years old and he is still struggling to pay that off. He actually told me about an experience he went through where he was laid off. And then 2 weeks later, his wife lost her job and he was able to figure out a repayment plan or to defer his federal student loans. But the private loan servicer he had would not work with him. And so he actually went into default on that loan.
Natalia, I imagine that story is not uncommon. When we think about politicians, certainly we've heard this as a refrain at every level, from the national level to the state level to the local level. What sense do you have right now of lawmakers trying to address this issue?
So the good news is that for the first time in history, we have more lawmakers, both in office and running, that have their own student debt than any time before. That's because, you know, even senators and congressmen cannot escape this crisis either. I have been working on this issue of student loan debt since 2010. And I can tell you that we have increased exponentially the number of people that are aware of this issue and are working on it. Now it's our job to really push them hard to make changes. But I have a lot of hope. I know it doesn't feel that way for the borrower that's struggling to make ends meet, that's in default. But there are people now that truly understand this problem the way it is today, not the problem our parents had, which was nothing compared to this crisis. So it will get better. We just have to make sure to vote candidates in that understand the issue of student loan debt.
That's Natalia Abrams. She is the executive director of studentdebtcrisis.org. They're a nonprofit that advocates for state and federal policies to lessen the impact of student debt. We're answering a question that was posed to the Illinois Newsroom. Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines has been looking at this, basically where candidates stand on the issue of student debt. And so let's get to these ideas, because we have lots of different offices to go through here. And let's start with candidates for governor. Start with our current governor, Bruce Browner. He actually vetoed the Illinois Student Loan Bill of Rights, although that was eventually signed into law anyway. But just this year, he did sign legislation that creates a pilot program to better educate students about loans, repayment options, and interest fees. What do we know about where the governor stands? Because obviously there's lots of pieces when we're talking about student debt.
Yeah, and I do want to make a note that Governor Rauner was one of two candidates that did not respond to my request for comment on this story. So I didn't get a chance to hear from him directly or his campaign about where he stood. So I had to kind of look at his legislative history. So, right. He did veto the Illinois Student Loan Bill of Rights, which for listeners that might not know what it requires loan companies not to mislead or ignore their student loan borrowers, basically. And so that will actually take effect in December of this year.
That veto was overridden.
So that veto was overridden, which is important to note. But yes, you're right. He did sign a bill which was supported by Lisa Madigan. So that prevents the state from suspending or terminating professional licenses, which are held by people who might have gone into default or might not be able to make their student loan payments. And then he also increased investment in higher ed this year. He created this Aim High program, which provides $25 million in state matching funds to basically create a merit-based scholarship program.
And so you mentioned one of two candidates did not respond to you. Did you hear back from J.B. Pritzker, who's his Democratic challenger?
I did. I did hear back from Pritzker. His campaign sent me a statement. And so essentially what Pritzker wants is he wants more funding for MAP grants. And
he has like a whole higher education plan.
He does.
Okay.
So he wants more. The key takeaways from that, I would say, is he wants more funding for MAP grants. And for people that don't know what those are, it's the monetary assistance program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So those are not merit-based. Those are based on financial need.
Those are kind of like our state version of Pell Grants. Is that
exactly
an accurate way to describe it?
Yes. And you also qualify for them if you attend a school in Illinois and are also an Illinois resident. So he wants to increase funding for those. And he also wants to do something which is a state administered school loan refinancing program. And this is something I talked to Natalia about. I actually didn't know much about these, but essentially it's the state can purchase your student loan debt and then you pay that loan back to the state at a lower interest rate.
Oh, am so I sort getting... of like the state's refinancing, Natalia? Is that what they're doing?
Well, we have seen state refinance programs. They do actually, in a sense, convert your loan to a private loan because you're taking it out of the federal government loan. But that is something we encourage states to do. Wisconsin had a great bill, the higher ed lower debt bill, which did not pass, but it was refinancing on the state level. So that is one of the things that all states across the country can do to help student loan borrowers without waiting for the federal government to act.
Mm. And so you mentioned, Lee, our outgoing Attorney General, Lisa Madigan. She's been pretty active in advocating for reform, especially when it comes to predatory lenders, but also just in general around this issue of student debt. Candidate Kwame Raoul, he's the Democratic candidate. He's also promised to continue Madigan's legacy by, quote, cracking down on lenders, services and institutions that defraud students. What about his Republican opponent, Erica Harrell? Does she also agree on that?
She does. There really wasn't much daylight in between the responses.
So both of them are pretty similar.
They're pretty similar. She supported Madigan's actions against Navient and the predecessor being Sallie Mae. So Madigan went after Navient for peddling subprime mortgages to student loan borrowers and just generally not fulfilling its duties as a loan servicer. And so she supports that. She also advocates for increased transparency and disclosure from loan service providers.
And as we think about that, so as Lee's just to underscore, it sounds like Kwame Raoul, the Democrat candidate for attorney general, Erica Harrell, the Republican candidate, both of them have pretty similar issues on this. Natalia, how important is a state attorney general when it comes to regulating student loan lenders?
Very important. And I'm also very pleased to hear that this is turning out to be a nonpartisan issue in the state of Illinois, that both of your AGs care about student loan borrowers. That's music to my ears. The AGs are incredibly powerful, especially in our current federal landscape. Our Attorney General, Javier Becerra, sued Navient, the most complained about student loan company, and he was joined by many attorney generals. They have been incredibly helpful with those borrower bill of rights that you're talking about and making sure these servicers, and just explain a servicer abuse for an example, is when you call to say, I am not making enough money, I can't make my student loan payments. Most of the time they'll throw you into a deferment program instead of a repayment program. They do not tell you of everything you need to know. And actually it's due to Lisa Madigan's fantastic work where she discovered that those servicers have 6 minutes to talk to you on the phone. If I talk to a borrower, it can take a half an hour or more. We need more time and more information, and that's what the attorney generals are really working on, is for more transparency and to go after the bad actors. So they're incredibly vital in this process.
Thanks for that. Lee, we have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about our congressional candidates. I think we've certainly heard a lot about this. To Natalia's point, on a bipartisan basis, we heard this last week in the debate between the 13th Congressional District, between Rodney Davis and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. What are we hearing in other districts? I'm thinking about the 14th Congressional District with Randy Holmgren, who's running against Lauren Underwood, mm-hmm. or the 16th District.
So Randy Holmgren, again, he reintroduced legislation to require more transparency from lenders.
Kind of along the lines of what Governor Rauner has done.
Exactly.
Sort of I don't know if that's a Republican position or not, but okay.
And his opponent in that race, Laura Underwood, she wants increased money for Pell Grants, and she wants to subsidize more federal student loans and a continuance of public service loan forgiveness. So that's if you work a certain type of job, your loan is forgiven, essentially.
And remind us about Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan and Rodney Davis, what they've said about this issue.
Rodney Davis feels very passionately about two bills that he has been unable to pass. And one of those would prevent taxing tuition waivers. So a lot of places don't tax them, but there are some places that still do. So you wouldn't have to pay tax on the $60,000 that you're not paying to the University of Illinois, for example, because you're a graduate student. So he doesn't want students to be penalized for that. The other issue is he wants to incentivize employers to help borrowers pay off their loans. So I would characterize it in general. He's really in favor of employers coming in and taking some of the burden off their student loan borrower employees. He is not in favor of more federal refinancing options, but Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan is.
As we are just thinking about this, Natalia, as voters, I wonder, even if you're not holding student debt, you probably know someone who is, but why you think it's important to consider these stances as we head to the polls?
So it's a very good point. We have 45 million borrowers, but that's the borrower themselves. They have parents, they have brothers, they have sisters. You know, I've seen some studies that say it's about 200 million people that are in not directly impacted, but are still dealing with this issue of student loan debt. But besides that, if you're a homeowner, you need somebody to buy your home when you want to sell it. We all want the economy to do well. We, you know, a lot of us were adults in 2008. We remember what it was like when the economy tanked and it affected all of us. And we can't continue to see this go. When I started, it was $1 trillion. It's going to be $2 trillion before we know it. So we need to do something now, or this will turn into something like the housing crisis, and then we will all be wondering why we didn't do something sooner. So now and November 6th is your time to act and vote and make sure that we can end this crisis and many others going on in this country right now.
That's Natalia Abrams. She's the executive director of studentdebtcrisis.org. I want to thank her, along with Lee Gaines. Lee's reporting on this for the Illinois Newsroom. We will tweet out if you want to see more information about this. And by the way, of course, as Natalia mentioned, Election Day is on November 6th. If you are registering now and voting early, you can go to our website at 21stshow.org. And we've got the ballot information for you there. Our friends with the Illinois Newsroom have put together this handy voter guide. So if you go to 21stshow.org and just look to the right and click on IL Votes, that will give you a customized ballot if you enter your address. Then you'll know what district you're in, who's on the ballot, all of that to be prepared for you for Election Day or if you're early voting. Lee, Natalia, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, publishers of New Media Futures, The Rise of Women in the Digital Arts. A symposium featuring these trailblazing women will take place on Friday, October 26th at NCSA, the University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Over the past year, Roman Catholics have been seeing the issue of sexual abuse come up yet again. Whether it's the resignation of Cardinal Theodore McCarrick or the grand jury report in Pennsylvania, which found that nearly 1,000 children were abused over a period of 70 years. Here in Illinois, State Attorney General Lisa Madigan is also investigating church authorities. And last Thursday, the story took yet another turn. Four people have sued all of the Catholic dioceses in the state of Illinois. They say that there was abuse by priests in Rockford, Peoria, and Springfield, and that in all six dioceses in Illinois have covered up sexual abuse by members of the clergy. The plaintiffs want all of those dioceses to release the names of all priests who've been accused. Their lawyer, Jeff Anderson, has also filed similar lawsuits in California and Minnesota. Jeff wasn't able to join us this morning, but he sent us a statement that he filed the suit because of a danger of harm to kids, parishioners, and people. And quote, he said, if we are going to protect our kids, then these names need to be known and revealed. We have also reached out to all six of the dioceses. We have statements from those who have responded to us at our website on the 21stshow.org, and I tweeted them out. We're going to get to some of those statements in a minute. Heidi Schlump is with us as a correspondent from the National Catholic Reporter. She's with us from Chicago. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Heidi, let's start with this lawsuit and with the four plaintiffs who are involved. I just mentioned briefly that four people have sued all of the six Catholic dioceses in the state. Who are these people and what are they alleging?
Yes. So last Thursday, the attorney, Jeff Anderson, who's represented many, many victims of clergy sexual abuse over the decades, announced this lawsuit in Illinois. And he had three victims with him at the press conference. There's a fourth victim who is remaining anonymous. And they allege a variety of abuse that has happened, some of it in the pretty distant past. So some of the abuse goes back to 1979. Some of it is as recent as 1999. And what's interesting is that the lawsuit is not just about the sex abuse. So this isn't, they actually sues for conspiracy to conceal a public hazard. So it's about this idea that the diocese, both the three dioceses where the abuse happened, but in addition that the other dioceses were also negligent by not releasing the names of priests with credible accusations of abuse. And so they've named all six dioceses in Illinois, as well as the Catholic Conference of Illinois, which is a federation of the six dioceses, and the La Salette missionaries, because one of the alleged abusers was a member of that religious order.
I wonder if you can take a step back here, Heidi, and just explain a little bit of the structure of the Catholic Church, because it makes sense now why they have sued all six, even if they're saying that there was abuse in a few cities. But what is the rationale, and how does this work in terms of how each individual district works within the Catholic Church?
Yeah, so the Catholic Church is organized geographically into these dioceses, and then each and so they're based on a geographic area. So we have the dioceses in Illinois. We have six of them. One of them is an archdiocese, generally where the largest city in the state is. For us, that's the Archdiocese of Chicago. And an archdiocese is headed by an archbishop, as a diocese is headed by a bishop. And the archdiocese then has some authority over the other diocese. What Jeff Anderson is doing, though, is doing these lawsuits based on the states where he thinks that the laws are amenable to this kind of lawsuit that's, again, not just about the sex abuse, but about what they see as a cover-up because of the not releasing the names of all the credibly accused. Now, it is true, and Anderson acknowledged that there are dioceses within Illinois, Chicago, Joliet, and Peoria that have released names of credibly accused priests, but he called that a half-truth because they have not released all the names. So he's specifically talking about priests who are members of religious orders as opposed to diocesan priests, and as well as some priests who are deceased who have been accused. So some dioceses release accused priest names who are deceased depending on whether they had a chance to respond to the accusation before they died or not.
And so I mentioned that a lawyer, Jeff Anderson, who wasn't able to join us, did send us a statement saying the reason they're asking for the release of names, even if the accused have died, is because even though they no longer pose, obviously, a risk of harm, the survivors are still living, quote, in secrecy and shame, feeling like they are alone. They need to know they are not alone. They need to have this information to help in healing and to be believed. Heidi, so you mentioned there's a couple places in Illinois that have released, Chicago being the most, obviously the largest example. Is this happening in other states? Are there victims that are asking for a full release of names, even if, as you've mentioned, even if the accused has passed away?
Yes, and I think this idea of releasing the names of credibly accused abusers has become a symbol of how the church could cooperate and not be part of the cover-up or the hiding of this sexual abuse that's been part of the church's past and in some cases still in the present. So our newspaper, the National Catholic Reporter, has long advocated for that as at least a first step in trying to not cover up. So getting the names out there, this is helpful to victims to feel validated, they've said, but also it's an opportunity for someone who may have experienced abuse but was feeling, you know, unsure about it or not thinking they were alone, being able to see that there have been other allegations against a possible perpetrator. So we're seeing a lot of movement since a lot of the sex abuse news that has happened this summer, where many dioceses are now starting to release names voluntarily. So just recently announced that Washington, D.C. Archdiocese will be releasing names. All 15 dioceses in Texas are going to be releasing names, Sacramento, San Jose, Shreveport. We have a reporter who's been contacting every, I think we have 167 or 8 dioceses in the country to see if they have already publicly listed these names or are planning to do it. He's up to about 50, late 50s, or but maybe about 60 dioceses that are doing it. So you can see it's still a minority.
And so, Heidi, the Springfield Diocese, and as I mentioned, we've gotten statements from quite a few of these, and they're very lengthy statements, and we wanted to make sure people had a chance to read all the details of it. So we have posted it at our website at 21stshow.org, particularly the Chicago response is very long. It's multiple pages if people are interested in reading that. But I wanted to just highlight one response that we got from Springfield, Heidi. They pushed back against the claim that they've been hiding the identities of sexual abusers. They released a statement after the lawsuit was announced, and they said that they've been working cooperatively with the Illinois Attorney General's office to respond to requests for information relating to past and present practices of handling allegations of sexual abuse by minors and church personnel. That's a direct quote. And then they go on to say they inform local law enforcement and review allegations through a review board. So, Heidi, if I'm reading this correctly, they're saying the diocese is doing what it can to inform the public by working with state and local law enforcement. But that's not what this lawsuit is asking, and that's not what you just described in terms of what we're seeing happen in other parts of the country.
Yeah, so I do think that there was some pushback from some of the dioceses about the specific cases that are named in this lawsuit. And, of course, we won't know until this, you know, if and until this goes to court, who's telling the truth about some of these details. So it is possible that dioceses are cooperating in some ways, but not doing what Anderson and his plaintiffs are asking for. So Springfield, you know, the specific victim who was speaking was a woman who talked about being abused when she was 6 years old. She was particularly upset that the previous Bishop of Springfield, who has since moved to Nebraska, did not who met with her did not apologize and acknowledge her abuse in the way that she had hoped. And she is not seeking damages. She's just seeking for the release of names. So currently Springfield does not release names. So a number of the statements from the diocese said that they were cooperating with the Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, in her investigation. But some might see that as sort of the bare minimum of what they should do.
That's Heidi Schlump. She's a national correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter in Chicago. I wanted to bring Christina Trena into this conversation. She's a professor and chair of religious studies at Northwestern University. Hi, Christina. Thanks for being with us as well.
Good morning. Thanks for asking me.
Christina, you're someone who studies Catholic ethics. So I wanted to just start by getting your reaction to what Heidi was just saying about, even as we're looking at these different responses from these different districts, as they're saying they're complying with the law, that is, I want to make a distinction between that, complying with the law, complying with authorities, and then also the full transparency and also maybe even thinking about rebuilding trust within these communities of people who have been abused.
That's a very important point. Complying with the law and full transparency and rebuilding trust, I think those are three different levels of responsibility and accountability, right? And so we must go beyond even transparency to rebuilding trust. I think the problem with the rebuilding trust, however, is a structural problem. Even if all the dioceses release names, and even if all the bishops compassionately apologize for the violations that happened in their diocese, we still haven't mended the structural problems that lead to the possibility, or the likelihood, actually, that there will be a cover-up of some kind. And that's because every bishop is essentially the king or prince of his own diocese. He has sole authority over it. And it's really only the Pope who can dictate that bishop perform or behave in a particular way. for instance, by releasing names. Even the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, when it adopts a policy that all dioceses are ostensibly to enact, has no authority over individual bishops to make sure that they do that. And as long as that structural problem exists, then it will be very difficult to regain trust in the long run.
And so I think part of this, when you say that, that it really comes down to the bishops. One thing that struck me as I was looking through all of the statements that we got back, and we have statements, by the way, from all, we have from five of the six. So every diocese but Belleville, we have statements on our website. Only two of the, a few of them had in the statement how you could report abuse. So Rockford had in their statement, if they said, while allegations are rare, we remain vigilant in regularly reviewing and updating our policies and encouraging victims to come forward. They have a hotline number. They have a reporting structure that they have within the, their statement that they released. And that struck me because it's kind of crazy to me to think that there isn't a reporting system that's standardized across the Catholic Church now for people to report abuse, right? Even after all these years?
That is very true. Right. There's not a standardized system for reporting abuse. There's not a standardized system for training volunteers to notice when an adult might be grooming a child. There's not a standardized system for these things, and there's no way to demand a standardized system for it unless the Pope actually signs off on a dictum about that.
And Heidi, do you think that's part of what these lawsuits are also trying to force some kind of a national change? And people are just doing this at the individual level through the legal system by suing individual, suing different parishes throughout the country?
Well, yes. I mean, throughout the decades since sexual abuse has been publicized as an issue in the church, and we've been reporting on that since the 80s, but it really all blew up in 2002 with the Boston Globe's reporting based out of Boston, is that many of these victims came to the church and sought help and justice and did not get it. And so they turned to the legal system to try to force the church to acknowledge their abuse and to at least, you know, give them some sort of recompense. Dr. Trainer is correct in saying that the way the church is currently structured, it's not possible for that way of having some sort of national. We do have some national norms, but it's up to each bishop how they are enacted in his diocese. Now, the bishops are getting together to meet in a couple weeks, November 12th through 14th in Baltimore. All the U.S. bishops will be gathering for their annual meeting, and this is at the top of their agenda. When I was in Rome last week, I was able to talk to Cardinal Supic from Chicago, who was also there, about this very issue, and he very clearly said the bishops are going to have to agree to let go of some of that authority that they are given so that there can be some oversight, preferably by lay people, not by other bishops, so that we can move towards a system that's more just and more transparent.
There's so much to get to here. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Christina, I just wanted to ask you, we just have about a minute left. Did you want to add something to what Heidi was saying there?
I did, if I could quickly. Just that there are four ways ordinary Catholics can try to affect change in the church. She mentioned two of them. One of them is just simply asking for recognition. Another one is using lawsuits. The other two that are available are shaming, which hasn't worked very well, and withholding financial contributions. And that's why we're seeing lawsuits. That's why we're seeing people withdrawing financial support from the church, because there are very few ways in which people can structurally get the attention of the bishops. That's why Cardinal Supic's proposal that lay people possibly have authority in these cases is so important.
So we will keep an eye on that and see how that plays out. I want to thank Heidi Schlump for being with us, national correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter based in Chicago, along with Christina Trainer, who is the chair of the Religious Studies Department at Northwestern University, where she also teaches. Both of you ladies, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Michelle Regenvetter from the Department of Psychology. Behavioral Decision Research meets Supercomputing, Wednesday, October 24th at noon at the Levis Faculty Center. More information is available at cas.illinois.edu.
Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, Sears announced it was filing for bankruptcy and closing 142 of its stores that are losing money, four of those right here in Illinois. This, of course, has had a lot of people talking about the loss of jobs, the impact on nearby real estate, what this means for the future of big retail, as well as one of Illinois' most known brands. You can find our conversation on this last week at our website, 21stshow.org. There was also a Twitter thread that was started by Lewis Hyman, a professor at Cornell University, that sparked a lot of interest and got us thinking about another side of Sears, not its softer side, but its radical one. He tweeted, "In my history of consumption class, I teach about Sears, but what most people don't know is just how radical the catalog was in the era of Jim Crow. So what can we learn about the ways Sears was a disruptor?" Lewis Hyman is on the line with us now from New York. He's an economic historian and the director of the Institute for Workplace Studies at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations for Cornell University. Hi, Lewis. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So I wonder if you can maybe start by helping us understand where people were shopping the time Sears started, because I think we tend to focus so much on the present Sears of its store presence, having a physical store presence, Sears and Kmart. We forget about its history. And I'm thinking about the late 1800s, the Jim Crow era. What was retail like then?
Well, most Americans were living in rural America, and in those rural areas, especially in the South, people shopped at one store. It was the general store, and it was basically a monopoly relationship. It was the one place where you could go and get credit because you had to wait until the harvest to get all your accounts settled. And if you were a sharecropper, especially if you were a black sharecropper, it was a very fraught relationship.
And so how does it fraught in a lot of ways? I wonder if you can help us understand not just economically, but how Jim Crow laws, especially when we're talking about in the South, affected African Americans' ability to actually even buy things.
Absolutely. So, of course, there is the monopoly relationship and its economic problems. But just like today, the way in which monopoly carries over into politics is really the concerning part. And so in the era of Jim Crow, which began around 1890 in Mississippi, it was a time when African Americans were forced to defer in all things to white people in public spaces like restaurants and trains and stores. And behind that deference was not simply discrimination or like waiting a little longer. It was a threat of violence. If you stepped out of line, you could be killed. Your family could be killed. Your property could be taken away. And so the catalog offered a way for African-American shoppers to avoid those very dangerous situations.
Dangerous situations, and certainly, I mean, I think we hear stories in the past, and we think about how many people, when we think about how many people were lynched, for example, and a lot of those are interactions that maybe happened at a store. I mean, this really was life-threatening in some ways just to do things like go into a store. Lewis, so Sears comes along as a catalog company. I wonder if you can help us with that. So how is this a game changer, just the fact that, first of all, they're offering people things to buy by catalog?
Yeah, just imagine if every time you went to the store, you were afraid of what could happen to you or your family. And suddenly there's this catalog, and you can look in it, and you can see the streets of Chicago. You can see all the things that are available for sale there. And in your local store, the white shopkeeper wouldn't let you buy the same shirts as white people or buy the same flour as white people. And in this catalog, you can buy whatever you want, the same things as white people have, the higher quality things. And Sears offered credit, just like your local store did. So people were able to buy things at a distance. And it was a pretty amazing intervention in a time when everything was so local and so bound up in these kinds of power relationships that were about race, to have something that was about market relationships and really helped people, especially black people, get out of those situations.
So how did they, I think people who are in Chicago know if you've been to Chicago, you know the old post office and how big it was, and people who know Chicago history know that was because of the catalog operations. That's the building it's a huge building that's, I think, still abandoned right now. But how was this catalog, and if we're thinking about the late 1800s, how were people getting this in the South? Was this catalog being mailed to everybody, or how did that happen?
You could request it. It could be smuggled in. It could be passed from person to person. You know, the other great Chicago institution of that time was the African American newspaper,
the Defender, the
Chicago Defender. Yeah, and you know, which itself was contraband in the South. You couldn't directly send it through the mail. So it was the kind of thing that had to be sort of passed along. There were active resistance movements by Southern storekeepers to keep it out of the hands, of course, not just Black people, but white people, because it threatened their business. But it had so much more meaning to African Americans. And so there were bonfires in the street. There were rewards for burning the most catalogs. That's just how radical this catalog was. And, you know, it was something where Chicago could project its consumer culture into the world. It was like being at one of those big department stores downtown, only you were in the county in which you were born and you had never left. So it was a pretty amazing thing.
It is kind of crazy to think of how much of a disruptor it was that there were people who were burning Sears catalogs in the street.
Yeah.
But then also I wonder how even, and I read a little bit more of this as I was reading into your Twitter thread that you tweeted about this last week. Even so, I guess Sears worked really hard to even accommodate, because a customer is a customer, I guess, in Sears' eyes at the time, right? Whether or not they were Black or white. So even if you couldn't read, it didn't matter how literate you were, they could kind of still figure out how to fulfill your catalog order. Is that what was also happening then, too?
They really tried to make it open for everyone. You know, there were, obviously, it was a time of great immigration to the U.S. People didn't speak English, so you could order in Swedish or German or any other language. You could scribble out something, and hopefully the postman could help you place the order. You could even just ask the postman to place buy a money order, because, of course, many of these post offices in very small, very rural, remote areas were also the general store. And so evading that was
wow. Talk
tricky.
About a monopoly, right?
Yeah, no, it was very hard. It was very hard, and so figuring out ways around it. Obviously, not always successful, but sometimes, and enough that in the catalog itself are printed instructions in how to evade your local post office by going to a postman directly. And it really speaks to how Sears Roebuck, you know, was trying to sell, but also the way in which they were able to help people who might otherwise not have such access.
And what do we know about Sears leadership at the time? Was this something that was altruistic, or were they just trying to sell more products?
Well, I mean, what's great to me is that, you know, it doesn't really matter. They were selling products and it did help people. And, you know, I think that the Sears leadership was actually pretty, you know, liberal for the time. And certainly Julius Rosenwald, who eventually becomes part of the leadership team there, along with Richard Sears. He's a Jewish suit maker from Chicago, and he eventually goes on to found, you know, many, many, many schools for African-American children around the South, the Rosenwald schools, donating millions of his own dollars. So he's obviously very racially liberal. And I think it's interesting to think about it both ways, both, you know, as how business can disrupt entrenched power, but also, you know, how it doesn't even matter as long as you are, you know, helping people get access and the radicalness of markets.
Louis, I want to return to that in a minute, but I just want to ask you a question. There was even a rumor at one point in time, just in terms of the resistance that was put up by particularly Southern, as you were saying, general store owners, and I imagine also just different Southern groups that were trying to enforce Jim Crow laws, different white supremacist groups. There was a rumor that Sears and Roebuck was actually a Black company, right?
Absolutely, that, you know, they couldn't show their face. This idea of you were shopping with people you'd never met, right? And they were not showing their face because they were Black, and that was something to be ashamed of, and that white people shouldn't shop with them. So they actually published pictures to, quote-unquote, prove that they were white.
Sears did.
Sears did, yeah. And so did Alva Roebuck. And it's interesting in the way in which that story has persisted. You know, certainly what I found on Twitter was that a lot of people who are of Black descent, you know, they had heard stories proudly that Roebuck was Black and that this was something to be proud of. And, you know, it certainly would have been, but I think also just it speaks to the ways in which race is so intertwined with this story and the story of power and liberation.
I'm speaking with economic historian Louis Hyman. He teaches at Cornell University. And Louis, so your tweet, this thread that you had, I think it was like something like 17,000 retweets.
It was
incredible engagement that people had with this online. I wonder what others, it's an interesting thing to me because first of all, my first thought was when I heard your name was an economic historian, I thought, what is that? But it's exactly this, isn't it? I mean, it's really understanding the role that the economy can intersect with history and culture, particularly when we're thinking about American society.
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it is just, you know, the history of business, the history of labor, the history of market conditions. But it's really about the way in which the economy intersects with other kinds of social and political considerations. So, you know, that Jim Crow was political, but also it was about everyday commercial transactions, about where you could and couldn't shop. And, you know, while we vote only every couple years, we shop every day. And it was that everydayness that made Jim Crow so frightening and so powerful. And, you know, I think it was interesting to see the connection it had to people on Twitter in thinking about, you know, contemporary conditions and the meaning, the legacy of Sears and the meaning of Amazon and all the other things. So hopefully history helps provide some context for thinking about the present day.
Right. And I wanted to ask you about the present day, because when we think about what it means for our shopping habits today, do you see contemporary examples of business disruptors? Or what about changing technology, specifically how you think that might continue to shift power?
Well, it was really interesting to see people's response on Twitter, to see, you know, so many people who are transgender talking about shopping on Amazon for clothes to avoid uncomfortable situations or dangerous situations. A lot of African-American shoppers were talking about how they've been trailed through stores by sort of white employees, and, you know, digital e-commerce was a way around that. So I think, you know, obviously it's not the same as the Jim Crow South, but I do think that there's a way in which when we're watched as we shop, it's uncomfortable. And you can see things that are the 21st century equivalent of the Sears catalog as something continuing that legacy.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way to think about our economy and the power that we have as consumers on both sides of this, right?
Absolutely. And the sort of radical nature of market relationships, you know, to see how simply having more access can be so important to people. And one of the important themes of African American history is the way in which African Americans never have really had access to a truly free market system as owners, as workers, as consumers, and how those things all interconnect.
Mm. Really interesting history about Sears. One of, as we know in Illinois, one of our most iconic brands. As it's just an interesting conversation that surfaced last week during the bankruptcy filing, and we wanted to bring that to you, Louis. Thanks for being with us, Louis Hyman is an associate professor and the director of the Institute for Workplace Studies at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University, and his latest book actually is called "Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary." Louis, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
A pleasure, anytime. Thank you.
By the way, if you want to see that the tweet that Louis sent out, we will retweet that in case you missed that thread. We'll embed that at our website at 21stshow.org as well. That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking travel with NPR's David Shaper as the holiday travel season approaches. We'll be asking him about what you need to know, also looking at fuel prices a little bit, how that's been changing. We're also going to be talking about a new study that looks at some of the mental health issues that animal vets face as they deal with the ethics of treating animals. As I mentioned, our website a couple of times, 21stshow.org, is a great resource, especially now as we're headed to the election. We have a special section where we have compiled all of our election coverage. So if you head to 21stshow.org, right at the top of the page, you can click on that link for our election coverage. If you look over to the right, we've got our voter guide embedded. Our friends at the Illinois Newsroom have put together a very handy voter guide. All you have to do is enter your address, and it will tell you everything that will be on your ballot, including your congressional districts. We know sometimes those numbers are hard to figure out, and how to register and what you need to do to bring to the polls. So you can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on that. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We'll see you back here tomorrow.